Indigenous people, shine your light, we are equal. I remember the days when our prayers were illegal. I remember the days when being Indian was lethal. Yeah, we had a rough past, but get ready for the sequel. Get ready for the glorious comeback of our people. Oh, yeah. Rise up.
Hello, and thank you for joining us for this evening's edition of K-Mud Public Affairs. Tonight, I'll be joined by Bill Tripp, a member of the Karuk tribe and the tribe's director of natural resources. We'll be discussing the historic agreement between the tribe and the state, which strengthens tribal sovereignty and expands cultural burning, a practice that provides climate resilience for all communities, including plant and animals. I'm your host, Lauren Schmidt, and you have it tuned to K-Mud.
We don't have to hide anymore, 'cause now's our time.
A new law in California is restoring indigenous land stewardship practices and strengthening tribal sovereignty. Senate Bill 310, now in effect, acknowledges the right of federally recognized tribes to conduct cultural burns without state permits, reversing historic restrictions on traditional fire practices. Under this law, the Karuk tribe and the California Natural Resources Agency have signed a groundbreaking agreement, allowing the tribe to use fire for ecological and cultural purposes in their ancestral territory, which includes northeastern Humboldt and western Siskiyou counties. This agreement allows the tribe to apply good fire to the land, a practice that has been carried out since time immemorial, without the bureaucratic barriers of prescribed burns or other Western fire regimes. Advocates say this marks a significant step in reducing catastrophic wildfires and revitalizing traditional ecological knowledge. Fire is foundational to the Karuk tribe, which stewards over 1 million acres of its ancestral lands along the Klamath and Salmon rivers. By removing accumulated fuels, fire creates space for new growth and change. This renewal helps sustain traditional foods and cultural materials, while serving as a medium for cultural education. Fire-centered ceremonies strengthens the tribe's social networks and enhance both physical and mental well-being. To learn more, I'm joined by a Karuk tribal member who has been a leader in restoring cultural fire and good fire to the landscape, locally, nationally, and even globally.
Yeah, I'm Bill Tripp. I'm the Director of Natural Resources and Environmental Policy for the Karuk Tribe's Department of Natural Resources. I oversee the department function ranging from water resources to upland forest management, inclusive of the environmental policy conversations surrounding the broad range of topics.
The Karuk tribe has been at the forefront of so many important efforts, particularly in cultural burning. Recently, there has been an exciting development with the state, a new agreement made possible by SB 310. Can you share more about this bill and what it means for the tribe?
Yeah, so Senate Bill 310 expands on a suite of authorities in California to kind of pull things together in a way that enables tribes to work with the state of California in a manner that is truly respective of tribal sovereignty, self-governance, and self-determination. And so, there's been a few laws passed in recent years, one of those being SB 332, which formally defined cultural fire practitioner in state law and started to enable a little bit of a difference there in tribes being able to determine who is able to conduct some burning. But what ultimately happened is there other laws were created around addressing the liability structures. It's really hard to get like insurance. It's hard to get anything done if you don't address liability up front. And so there was a Assembly Bill 926 that effectively started a cultural burning, a prescribed fire and cultural burning claims fund. What ended up happening in that law passing was that some of the things in SB 332, particularly the fact that cultural fire practitioners are not required to have a burn plan, a written burn plan to conduct burning, in order to access the prescribed fire and cultural burning claims fund, that ultimately ended up requiring a burn plan, which basically took away, kind of set that conversation backward when it came to cultural fire practitioners.
So SB 310 directly addresses those past barriers. Can you explain how it fixes the issue that have limited cultural burning in the past?
Now we have an authority in the state of California for tribes to enter into an agreement in lieu of a permitting process. And so it makes it to where there are no permits required and there's no burn plan required and all of those things when an agreement is in place, with the California Natural Resources Agency or even with local air districts are also provided an authority to enter into agreement with tribes. It doesn't say that that agreement is required. It says they may enter into agreements. And so, we currently don't have an agreement with our local air districts, but our local air districts currently don't require permits for tribally led burns. Our Siskiyou County Air Pollution Control District doesn't require permits at all. They just have a burn day notification status. So that said, we may or may not enter into an agreement on that end moving forward. That's yet to be determined. Right now, we just we're working through kind of a notification process, and we're sharing our data, and that data is clearly showing that we're not having a significant impact on air resources.
This really sounds like a step towards true sovereignty finally being recognized in California. But with that, I imagine some of our listeners might have concerns, especially given the widespread anxiety around fire. But in a recent interview we did with Margot Robbins of the Cultural Fire Management Council, she explained that cultural fires have never escaped and that in Karuk language, there isn't even a term for catastrophic fire. Can you speak to the safeguards in place for cultural burning and clarify that this isn't just about putting fire on the ground without planning?
In Karuk culture, we've lived here for thousands of years without a written language. And so when you don't have a written language, things like written burn plans and permit systems and all that kind of stuff are kind of just like a foreign language to you, right? And so our indigenous knowledge practice and belief systems are founded in practice and they're an oral founded in oral communication style and the ability to understand the cues that are presenting themselves in nature itself. Nature is infinitely complex. If you're trying to compartmentalize every single aspect of every little thing into writing, 9 times out of 10, you're probably going to get something wrong. And we see that in a lot of the burn plans that are being written out there today. Is a lot of times they're written in a way to where the you're there's one or two factors in there that just like, oh man, it's like we didn't think about that. We can't burn today now, but it's perfect time. And so this helps us to align with our values and our principles, and it gives us the ability to start to teach folks how to get out there at the right times and recognize those cues that are presenting themselves.
The press release about SB 310 mentions that it addresses historical injustices related to fire suppression laws. I want to highlight that intentional fire has been used here for thousands of years, but it has only been in the last 100 to 200 years that suppression policies have disrupted these practices. Can you talk about the impact of those injustices on tribal sovereignty and cultural revitalization?
Yeah, I mean, like, so one of the first laws created when California became a state was the Act for the Governance and Protection of Indians. Basically, it legalized, capturing and enslaving indigenous peoples that were found, roaming around out there in the wild. It criminalized setting fire to the prairies and things like that. So effectively, our cultural burning practices became kind of illegal. That had significant impacts. You didn't have a full-blown fire suppression workforce out there in the world at the time, but it gave folks a reason, basically either, arrest, if not kill people for being who they are. I think the statement that was issued when that law was passed was, basically from the governor, first governor of California, was saying that, to make no mistake, this is a war of extermination on Indians, and that we're not going to let up until they're all gone, right? And so, that had a huge impact. We've been lucky enough that we lived so remote, there really weren't a whole lot of people around here. There's not a whole lot of places to live. So some families were able to continue the practice. And a lot of the, miners and other folks, came in and started to mimic and some of those practices as well, albeit, sometimes for different uses, which, some cases had different outcomes that wouldn't necessarily be what the type of burning we're shooting for. But, and then around, the early 1900s, you had the big burn in 1910, which ultimately led to the passage of the Weeks Act, 1911. And so 1911 was the last time we were able to conduct our annual world renewal ceremonies on Offutt Mountain. That act was originally intended to be able to purchase lands in the east for conversion into the national forest system. And but Western governors were going to put some opposition to the bill. But what the piece that ultimately led to the Western states supporting the passage of that act was creating an authority for states and the federal government to coordinate when it comes to how wildland fire management programs were established. And so that ultimately ended up moving the feds, when the federal government was supposed to be protecting tribes from states, it ultimately turned into a scenario where federal government was helping states to squash these practices out. We've had some letters that are well documented from, like, around 1918, from a district ranger saying, every time you see an Indian or renegade, you're cussing this class of Indians and renegade whites or something like that, running around in the brush, lighting fires like a coyote to take a shot at them, So people were actively being, shot at and killed for these practices, even as late as 1918. And so, it's by 1932, the Forest Service had claimed that they'd eradicated the incendiary fire problem. Since then, it's been history. But some families continue to practice on smaller scales, and with the passage of these laws in California, now tribes, states, and the federal government are now, hopefully moving into an era of coordinating what the future of fire management looks like in a truly sovereign context.
That's great news. And as Dr. Lila June once put it, traditional ecological knowledge is 1,000-year-old solutions to modern-day problems. Can you expand on the role of TEK on broader environmental and climate resilience, not just in this region, but across the West Coast?
Yeah, well, you know, this question kind of draws me back to how indigenous traditional ecological knowledge is created, you know, and ultimately it's founded in an intricate, you know, knowledge practice and belief system, right? And so, you know, when you look at your standard of, you know, fire qualifications that you get out there today, you can't even get into a fire class and get out there and be part of a prescribed burn until you're 18 years old. By the time you start, you know, you end up going to college and all these other things before you get to the point to where you're getting exposed to writing burn plans and you know, preparing land management planning documentation and all of these things that the system requires today. And in the indigenous knowledge practice and belief system, you know, you're out there when you're tied into a baby basket, you know, watching the people, you're smelling the smells, you're hearing the birds and everything that is around you. And you know, by the time you're 4 years old, you're out there helping, you know, the elders do things, you know, and by the time you're 8 years old, you're out there, you know, helping the adults, you know, do a little bit more complex things. And you know, and so you're actually deeply immersed in this as a way of life. And so by the time you're 18 years old, you've already got a full career of experience behind you in that system. And so those are the types of things that kind of, it turns some of this almost instinctual. Like when I go to burn in the late winter burn window, you know, there's cues I look for, you know, as I start watching for the, you know, first I'll catch a little bit of a, you know, a smell in the air, you know, that's it. It'll be just, I'll just notice it, that the, you feel the temperature and the warmth on your skin, you feel the temperature of the air in your nose, you feel the humidity in your nose. And then it's like, oh man, I should go start looking for the manzanita. So I'll go take a look and see if the manzanita are blooming yet, or if it's still budding, you know, then you got to wait a little longer. And once it starts blooming, and then you'll, all of a sudden you'll see a bumblebee out there on those flowers, right? And so then now, you know, you can go burn under those black oak trees without, you know, impacting the, you know, that queen bumblebee that lives underneath that duff. And so it's, those are the types of things that just almost, they become instinctual cues that you just know it's time to go do it. So that's where the primary differences lie in my mind.
With the passage of SB 310, it's clear we're moving in the right direction, but are there still legal, social, or logistical barriers that need to be addressed before full sovereignty and implementation of cultural burning can be realized?
Well, yeah, I mean, when it comes to the scale of burning activity that we ultimately are going to have to do to restore historic fire regimes, you know, there's some potential for there to be what's called an exceedance in under the air quality management rules. There's a lot of dynamics at play there. And it's something that we probably have a lot more conversations on. Technically, the you know, Clean Air Act itself is more about managing, governing, and regulating industrial air pollution sources. It just so happens that people kind of consider prescribed fire as an agricultural practice, which then classifies it as an industrial practice because the Department of Agriculture primarily focuses on, you know, industrial timber management, and then agricultural communities are doing industrial agriculture. But the indigenous, you know, burning regimes are not an industrial practice. They are indigenous by the very term means natural to place. And so I think there's a lot of understanding that can be gained there. And that could, lead people to understand that technically this isn't, even if you do get short duration smoke impacts that kind of exceed the national standards, right, National Ambient Air Quality Management Standards, then it technically isn't a violation of the law. And some of those things can be really easily tracked by Air District and submitted as a variance. It's just a simple form that gets filled out that provides a variance to whatever like normal burn day operations that you would be doing. And so yeah, I think it's just a lot of education that needs to happen and a lot of understanding that needs to be gained. But we historically probably had at least 7,000 ignitions a year through our cultural burning regimes, spread out over, throughout 120 plus villages. And so that's a lot of burning. They're not all big fires, but it's still a lot of burning.
While we often associate cultural fire with the West Coast, it was actually a widespread practice across the United States, from the prairies to the Southeast. Do you see this agreement between the Karuk tribe and the California Natural Resources Agency as a potential model for other states and tribes to follow in recognizing and implementing indigenous stewardship practices?
I think it absolutely can, and I think the whole suite of laws that are being kind of passed in California can also help other states get there. And I know that like the Prescribed Fire and Cultural Burning Claims Fund, law has already kind of been replicated in Oregon, and there's some conversations about some of that stuff being replicated in other states like Washington and Colorado and Montana and so that is kind of happening. On the East Coast, it kind of a different thing happened in regards to what happened after the Weeks Act is that people kind of pushed back and they said, well, we learned how to do this from indigenous peoples and we're not going to stop, right? And because they had probably a little bit more influence in the political systems at play in the time over there. Fire, in large part, the human use of fire, in large part, was established as a right of the people back east. And so, a lot of those states already, are moving forward with, have been getting a lot of fire on the ground for decades. So, yeah, I don't think we're too far off. I know that there's folks in New Mexico, really pushing to get more fire on the ground, and Texas, and just all over the place. So I'm hopeful that we can really start to address these issues and revitalize these cultural practices.
Absolutely. And Bill, I want to thank you for taking the time to share this important information with our listeners. Before we wrap up, is there anything else you think folks should know about SB 310 or the future of Karuk cultural burning?
We are trying to build our cultural burning programs with non-federal and non-state dollars. And so we have built a what we call the Eco-Cultural Revitalization Fund at the Humboldt Area Foundation. And so, we're actively trying to build that fund to be able to support these practices as we go to broader scales. And so, if anyone wants any more information on that, we can sort out how to get folks in communication with the right folks to make donations or do fundraisers or whatever. What are kind of things that people want to do to kind of help?
And on that, really quickly, as we enter a time of uncertainty when it comes to federal programs and assistance, would you say that community support through local agencies working with the Karuk tribe is more critical than ever to ensure that this work continues?
Yeah, the more we can build our own resource base to make this a continuum of practice, I think the better off we'll all be. And so I'm just looking forward to having that kind of resource so I don't have to jump through all the hoops associated with spending those federal and state dollars when a landowner says, hey, I'd like to get some support to get this area, this oak woodland burned. in my backyard, we'll just be able to go do it at the right time of year rather than have to go through all of those processes.
Thank you again, Bill Tripp, Karuk tribal member and the director of the Department of Natural Resources with the tribe. Congratulations on this historic achievement, and we look forward to seeing more good fire on the ground.
All right. Well, thanks for giving me a call.
That wraps up this edition of KMUD Public Affairs. Thank you for joining us for this important discussion on Senate Bill 310 and its impact on tribal sovereignty and cultural burning. If you'd like to learn more about SB 310 and its role in restoring Indigenous land stewardship, you can find additional resources at kmud.org. You can also listen to this interview in full again on our website. Stay tuned for more local coverage, and as always, thank you for supporting Community Radio.
Yeah, yeah, I resurrect. Yes, you can bet. That we seen the single mama raising children on the res. We seen domestic violence tear apart what we have left. We seen the alcohol take it all and leave us dead. We seen the children take their lives when they can't take the dread anymore.
It's a war.
Can't take the dread anymore.
It's a war.
No, we can't take the dread anymore.
It's a war.
No, we can't take the dread anymore.
It's a war.
Yeah. It's a war, but we've seen it all before. And now we know we can change it, cause that's why we were born. We know we are the ones that we have been waiting for. We are the ones Grandma has been praying for.
So rise up, all you warriors of love. All you answers to the prayers of our ancestors from above.
I can feel it in my heart. Can you feel it in your blood? I can hear the seventh fire calling us to wake up.
Wake up.
Pueblo hermoso, levántense, es nuestro tiempo. No tienes que esconderte más. Ahora es nuestro tiempo.
Mujer indígena, tú eres tan sagrada. Traigas medicina de tu suelo todavía.
A pesar del abuso de tu cuerpo y tu tierra,
respetamos tus ancestros y la suya cultura.
Hombre indígena, tú eres honorable y yo veo la fuerza que todavía sobrevive.
A pesar del abuso de tu raza venerable,
yo respeto tus ritos, tus danzas, tus padres.
Somos guerreros del amor y guerreros de la paz.
Sí, no vamos a escondernos más.
Somos guerreros del amor y guerreros de la paz.
Sí, no vamos a escondernos más.
All nations
they
rise.
Say that history is written by the victors.
Rise up,
but how can there be a victor when the war isn't over?
Have to hide.
The battle has only just begun,
anymore,
and Creator is sending his very best warriors. And this time, it isn't Indians versus cowboys. No, this time, it is all the beautiful races of humanity together on the same side, and we are fighting to replace our fear with love. And this time, bullets, arrows, and cannonballs won't save us. The only weapons that are useful in this battle are the weapons of truth, faith, and compassion.